Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hey, Dwayne.
Hey, what's up, Andy?
How's it going, man?
It's going all right.
Did you get the email I sent you the other day?
No, I'm clicking around. I haven't gotten, got nothing from you.
Yeah, well, you know, that's probably because the NSA isn't done yet. They'll forward it when they're done.
Oh.
Well, we're going to be talking about the NSA, Glenn Greenwald's partner getting detained, Bradley Manning sentenced, and all that here on The Drill Down. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unafawakin.
This week, the man behind the biggest black market on the dark web, the biggest crowdfunding campaign ever, Mark Zuckerberg wants to give the entire world internet access, the iPhone in gold, the Tesla beats all safety records, and of course, our ongoing NSA surveillance coverage, and more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar, facebook.com, The Drill Down, and twitter.com, The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher, so go to stitcher.com and search for The Drill Down there. Let's get right into the headlines here. There's a fascinating article by Andy Greenberg in this month's Forbes magazine about the Dread Pirate Roberts, the shadowy figure behind the dark web site, the Silk Road. If you guys are not familiar with it, if our listeners are not familiar, in the last 2.5 years, the Silk Road has grown into the web's busiest bazaar for heroin, meth, crack cocaine, LSD, ecstasy, and marijuana. Anyone can download and run Tor, the Onion Router, exchange some dollars and euros for bitcoins, and go shopping on the Silk Road for drugs that are vacuum sealed and discreetly mailed via the U.S. Postal Service right under the federal government's nose. Silk Road takes a commission on all its sales, and since those are collected in bitcoins, which have appreciated close to 200-fold since the Silk Road launched in 2011, the Dread Pirate Roberts and any other stakeholders in the Silk Road have likely amassed millions in profits. Because it's an encrypted e-currency that, unlike Visa or MasterCard, can't be traced back to an individual, Bitcoin drives this market, and one can say that the market has made Bitcoin. Commenters on the site described the Dread Pirate Roberts as a hero, a job creator, our own Che Guevara, and a name that will live on amongst the greatest men and women in history as a soldier of justice and freedom.
Wow, such hyperbole.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's pretty hyperbolic, but it gives a lot of light to the story we covered last week about how Bitcoin was being brought in for questioning by the Department of Justice.
Right.
And the SEC, I think it was the SEC. The bottom line is there's some cloud around Bitcoin, what it's used for, and you know, obviously, if there's a serious black market going on.
For sure. I mean, since Silk Road and other dark web sites like this, trading sites like this, primarily run off of Bitcoin, one can say that has contributed to boosting the value of Bitcoin over the last couple of years.
People are going to find a way to make money when new ways of transferring money, you know, show up. And right. Clearly, you know, there are some enterprising people out there.
Anyway, it's a great article. I highly recommend everyone take a look at it. This guy, Dread Pirate Roberts, is articulate and well-educated. He's kind of like the Julian Assange of the black market. And Forbes has a companion piece article, too, where they just quote him. It's like the collected quotations of the Dread Pirate Roberts, which is also an entertaining read. He's like a champion for libertarianism. It just seems like a very fascinating individual, whoever he/or she might be. Right. So take a look at that.
And for those who don't know, that's from Princess Bride.
So, that's right. That's right.
Check out the film if you haven't.
The reason why he chose that name was because he did not start he didn't start Silk Road. Somebody else started it, and he inherited Silk Road from that person and took over their leadership. And that person essentially retired. The person who did start it retired, very wealthy. So he is the new Dread Pirate Roberts. Anyway, let's move on here. In other news, Canonical is still way off the pace to meet its ambitious $32 million target for its Ubuntu Edge crowdfunding campaign, but it's smashing records along the way. The Indiegogo page has now accrued over $12 million in pledges, topping the Pebble smartwatch as the highest ever fixed crowdfunding campaign. And I checked this out. It's an interesting project. It's the Ubuntu Edge is essentially a smartphone that runs Ubuntu. It's got 128 gigs of internal storage, dual LTE receivers, 4 gigs of RAM, and the ability to dual boot in both Android and Ubuntu. It's in fact, they send it when they ship it. They ship it out with Android, and the idea is it's going to run Android first until Ubuntu OS gets up on its feet as a mobile platform, and then you can boot it into Ubuntu directly. And not only that, this is another interesting thing about this project is it converts to a full desktop PC. You plug it into a monitor and Bluetooth it with a keyboard, and it's a full desktop PC right out of the box as the smartphone. I was going to say it's interesting that they've got over $12 million in pledges. They haven't quite met their, and I don't think they're going to meet their $32 million target because there's only a few hours left. However, because it's on Indiegogo, whatever money they do get, they get to keep and use, unlike Kickstarter, where if a Kickstarter campaign failed, they don't cash in the pledges. And the reward pledges for the device itself start at $695, which seems pricey, but when you consider, when you compare it to the retail price for any other smartphone on the market, it's comparably priced.
Or just when you want to buy the subsidized version of a 64-gigabyte iPhone, that's already $500.
Yeah,
so, that's true. Yeah. It's actually really interesting to see the success that you're getting so far, given that, if you remember some, do you guys remember the Open Moco?
Vaguely, that was another phone.
Yeah, that was another open source project phone that you can tell that you vaguely recall it now because it never saw light of day. It was definitely something that people were looking forward to, but it was just never marketed that well. And that's actually really interesting because it was before the time of the Kickstarter, the Indiegogo. So really, you'd have to really be in the know-how to follow such a project, and there wasn't really great means of supporting it. But I think what's kind of crazy to think these. Or at least what I find kind of crazy is just how extremely popular phones, a device like this is becoming, that so many people are willing to spend that much to back it, given that, you know, usually the lifetime or the life cycle of a phone is pretty low these days.
Yeah.
And at least in the U.S., everyone's used to subsidized devices. So people being willing to drop, you know, $700 really for a device is
but these devices they've never been cheap. You know, like you go to Europe, you're paying full price for them. The PDAs of old in the early 2000s were all $400, $500, $600. I feel like this is I'm actually surprised at the fact that they could get this cost down. And given the penetration of mobile technology, the idea that there is some upside, there is some opportunity out there to open up a new platform seems to make sense. If you think about the fact that, you know, we're going to talk about it later, but Zuckerberg's trying to get the 4 billion people on the internet. He's going to do it through mobile devices. there's just a lot of opportunity there, which is one of the reasons why Microsoft is still trying to play the mobile game with the Windows Phone, because they understand that there's a lot of opportunity out there, even though from, you know, it seems to be locked up by Android and iOS right now.
Yeah.
It's just not the case.
It is surprising, though, that although, you know, I guess this reaffirms what you said, that there is an opportunity out there for another player to be in the mix, especially given that we've seen, you know, Microsoft try and do it, as well as BlackBerry try and do it and not be as successful. It's pretty interesting to see that, you know, something with a little bit more flavor, something a little bit more open source could potentially get somewhere. Now, you know, this is now that being said, this is, you know, a small piece of the market so far. You know, they haven't made their Kickstarter, but their Indiegogo total amount, but it's definitely a start.
It also shows this is, I mean, I'd like to see who the backers are truly, if it is just all small donations, but it also goes to show that there are a significant amount of people who think an Ubuntu phone is worth it.
I'm curious to see how this project develops. When you consider it's also a desktop PC with in a small form factor, that's another. The $795 doesn't seem quite so pricey.
Oh no, so heavy, yeah.
All right. In other smartphone news, according to a source who has used the upcoming iPhone 5S, it'll come in a gold color option. Reportedly, the color is more in line with the yellow 5th generation iPod Touch, but slightly lighter in texture. Some have called this champagne. We've heard that this gold model has a white front face, so it won't be a black and gold device, but rather a white and slash gold slash champagne phone. And according to the source, it looks elegant and not cheap. I don't know. What do you think? What do you think? A gold iPhone? Is that, you know, where it, as the, what is it? The Moto X comes in any number of custom colors. And we don't, we think that's a positive selling point. Some people balk at the idea of an iPhone coming in something other than black or white.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about. It'd be interesting to see what the cost difference is. You know, Apple's always been known for you know, appealing to the luxury market, even though some of the devices are the most inexpensive or available. This might be another way of getting there. You know, throw a couple hundred more dollars on, say you've got the gold one. I don't know. We'll see. It's interesting. I still kind of feel like I'm still a little skeptical, despite the fact that people are talking about this so regularly. It just sounds like a strange way to move the product forward. But then again, you know, if you can find money there, if you can say, hey, $1,000 for the same exact phone with this orange back, or you can just open the pot a little by testing and saying, hey, would a gold phone work? You know, we'll see how that happens. For me, I typically use a case. I don't know if a gold phone's going to sway me. We'll see.
Yeah, I think many people use cases these days as their differential when it comes to iPhones. I'm not sure how well a gold color will do, but if, you know,
and that might
if
be
Steve Jobs Apple's was still around, I'm not necessarily sure that this would
I was going to say
occur.
The same thing.
Well, it depends. Like, he did make that the case, the first iPhone case made by Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was a lot of money made in those cases. They were $30, but they really cost about a penny or two to make. And I really feel as if what we're seeing is possibly Apple seeing if it could, you know, maybe if it costs $30-$40 extra to have this colored version, if it does cost any more money, they're getting that money out of you because you won't put a case on it. They also want their brand out there more. So offering colors, as is the case with the iPod, you're in a position where the devices aren't getting covered up by third-party cases, and your Apple logo is out there more. So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why a brand would want to move in this direction. You know, I'm anxious to see how it works out.
Apparently, one of the inspirations for this is that gold aftermarket accessory cases are the number one selling color of any cases for the iPhone. iTunes Radio, Apple's answer to Pandora, is set to debut next month with a handful of high-profile brand partners, including McDonald's, Nissan, Pepsi, Procter & Gamble, and possibly one or two more brands. Advertisements on iTunes Radio will come in three forms: interstitial audio and video ads, and slate ads. Users will be served an audio ad once every 15 minutes and one video ad every hour. Of course, consumers can choose to have no ads at all. iTunes Radio will be a free ad-supported service to the public, but Apple will, of course, be offering an ad-free option to anyone who purchases iTunes Match. So this is like the first real confirmation of a time frame for iTunes Radio that we've heard. So coming up in the next month, that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, doesn't it sound so? I tend to use Spotify.
Yeah,
a relatively lengthy amount of time, and I still currently have a free Spotify account because I often also just stream music from my home computer, but. It, to me, it seems like they're like 15 minutes is more often than something that's like Spotify. It seems like that's more regular.
How often do you hear ads on?
I can't tell you exactly, but it feels to me, it feels like Spotify actually does a range of time frames. Mm. So it's not necessarily you never completely expect it. I could be wrong, but
it's about your listening behavior and the songs that you're looking for and how they're paying for those songs. It's about trends, big data, and seeing what's correlating to the types of songs you're listening to. I mean, there are multiple ways to buy media on Spotify, and Pandora does something similar. There are also multiple ways to buy it on Pandora. Mm-hmm. Pandora's ramping up its advertising. I mean, if you look at Pandora and the kinds of songs you get, if you spend the $36 a year, you're not hearing any advertisements, and you just can keep on going. If iTunes wants to get into that game, and it is a straight up radio situation, not a Spotify choose your playlist, choose your song situation, then you know you're in an interesting position because you can, for $25 a year, you're undercutting Pandora by $11, and it's already on your phone. So Pandora, even though it has 70 million users, could see a lot of those users because recently eMarketer came out with a study, 99% more people this year use their phones and other mobile devices to stream music. These phones are in many ways, many of these devices are Apple phones. And if Apple's got it built in, then you begin to really see Pandora's link getting stolen. I think Spotify is a different story altogether. Spotify users tend to be really particular about the music they want to listen to. They want to grab that album the first day it came out. They want to do all that stuff, especially the paid customers. And what they want to do is they want to choose playlists and work with a more human centered way of curating their music. They like to do the curation themselves. So it's going to be an interesting marketplace to see, because I think the people who are in the most trouble here are not Spotify because of the way their users work, but the Pandora guys.
For 2/3 of the world, internet access is just not available, and this is something that Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg wants to change. In an announcement this week, working in conjunction with Ericsson, MediaTek, Nokia, Opera, Qualcomm, and Samsung, Zuckerberg introduced internet.org, an initiative that aims to help bring web access to the 5 billion people who are not yet connected. Internet.org's commendable aim is set out in a humbling and inspiring mission statement, which recognizes three main obstacles to global internet availability: cost, bandwidth, and suitable business models. The project partners plan to work together to help develop lower cost technologies and hardware that can be used around the world. Now, some critics on the internet have been saying that this is essentially Mark's insidious plan to get Facebook in front of every person in the world and therefore make them targeted ad customers.
Well, I mean, who cares? If you want to bring in connectivity to the planet, bring connectivity to anybody is a good thing. If it's sponsored by Facebook, which I don't think it will be, or if it gets people using Facebook, that's fine. But the fact is, we've all spoken and lauded these social networks for getting the word out when political things need to change, when revolutions need to happen, when news is being sequestered or stopped by governments. Giving people access to connectivity, giving the social animal the ability to be more social, mm-hmm. through mobile technology to communicate effectively across the world, to grab new ideas, to put into application processes, patterns, and technologies that they find on the internet in their locality, that's unabashedly a good thing. And if Mark Zuckerberg gets something out of that in the end, because more people on Facebook, he's got 7 billion people on Facebook, so be it. But the fact is, he's got the time to have a long-term vision. He's under 30. He's already in charge of he founded a humongous company, and he's got scope and he's got scale. So if he wants to use some of his amazing clout today as such a young person to advance the ability of people to connect on the internet and to invariably help their lives, because that's what it will do, kudos to him. Because even if he wants to, even if the whole point is to get people on Facebook, which is a fine point, then you know he's going to be using a socially respectable way to advance his industry. Let's also remember that Google is working on a plan to get people on the internet too around the world, their Project Loon, the balloon situation. And if that works, Google will be collecting a vast amount of data, an incredible amount of data on everybody that's going through them in these disparate parts of the world. So more companies, if you're an internet company, you want more users. And let's face it, the users coming onto these companies are going to be worth a lot less than the people in the developed nation world because they have a lot less money to spend. But even incrementally, as they use the internet and their fortunes change, so too will the fortunes change of Google and Facebook. So yeah, there's some people, he just wants people on Facebook, but it's a pretty ambitious plan. It's incredibly long term. And it's the kind of thing where I really feel like we have to focus on like what the real good's going to be, and it's going to be getting people online.
I think I definitely agree there. I think the long-term goals in terms of world connectivity outweigh the monetary goals from the organizations that are going to be doing this together. And remember, it's not just Facebook, but it's also, I believe, Samsung and some other large name companies are coming together.
Who all also have a stake in broadening their reach across the world.
Exactly.
All right, let's move on here. Independent testing by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has awarded the Tesla Model S a 5-star safety rating, not just overall, but in every subcategory without exception. Approximately 1% of all cars tested by the federal government achieve 5 stars across the board. It's an interesting distinction. There is they went through the tests on Tesla's own blog. They talk about the ratings across the board in the subcategories. And of note, during validation of the Model S roof crush protection at an independent commercial facility, the testing machine failed at just above 4 G's. The exact number is uncertain due to the Model S breaking the testing machine, but what that means is at least 4 additional fully loaded Model S vehicles could be placed on top of an owner's car before the roof caves in. That's pretty phenomenal that Tesla has not only, how many of these lists have they made? Car and Driver named them the best car they ever tested.
They gave them the top mark they've ever given.
Yes. Yes. I believe Consumer Reports also gave them their highest mark. And now they're the safest car ever made.
Yeah. Motor Trend gave them the 2013 car of the year. This safety rating is pretty phenomenal. I mean, American automotive engineering is back, and it's back in the form of not the big three in the traditional way that things happen, but in the form of the company that's effectively taken on a technology company model by focusing on California, Northern California, instead of Michigan and Detroit, and on focusing on innovating. My car today, I got a letter from the guys who make my car saying that Siri voice activation is going to be available in the 2014 model. Now, I don't have a 2014 model, so I called them up and said, hey, can I get an update or whatever? And I kind of knew the answer, but I still had to ask. And they're like, no, I mean, we just don't update them. If you can trade your car in to get this new feature. And that's ridiculous. A Tesla doesn't work that way. A Tesla, literally, you go home, your car connects to your Wi-Fi, and it updates all the software. And that's a technology company instead of a car company just trying to sort of leave you stagnant once your car has kind of been rolled off the lot. It's one of the reasons why Tesla's value will last beyond normal car, because it does have that roll off the lot upgradability. Just like your phone, just like your computer, just like any other piece of technology that you're working with. And let's face it, your computer and your mobile device and your vehicle, some of the most important technology pieces that you have in the day-to-day, in your day-to-day, aside from like the equipment in your kitchen. So they're really taking everything to task, and it's just another testament to what Elon Musk is trying to do when it comes to bringing us to the future. It's like his mission, bring us to the future.
And much like my smartphone, I would need some sort of subsidy before I can afford one, unfortunately. But that's my own problem.
It is expensive.
Yeah, yeah. But hopefully, an economy of scale will bring that price down, and then there'll be a Tesla that will be, like their economy car, their economy car version.
Yeah, they're working on it, so we'll hopefully hear about it next year, around this time.
I hope so. Knock wood, because I think that'll probably be the next car that I get. Is that whatever future Tesla design there is. All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I wanted to talk about this week is called Lexicon by Max Barry. I just finished reading this book. It is amazing. The publisher's description is, at an exclusive school somewhere outside of Arlington, Virginia, students aren't taught history, geography, or mathematics. Instead, they're taught to persuade. Here, the art of coercion has been raised to a science. Students harness the hidden power of language to manipulate the mind and learn to break down individuals in order to take control of their thoughts. The very best will graduate as poets, adept wielders of language, who belong to a nameless organization that is as influential as it is secretive. Now, this seems fairly sort of like you wouldn't expect a lot of action, but this is an action-packed book that travels around the world and involves a fair amount of violence as well. So it is this. As soon as I got into this book, it immediately occurred to me that they have to make this into a movie at some point, because it is just, it's action packed. It's got some great concepts in it. Essentially, the concept of the book is about the power of human speech to control other human beings. And it goes all the way back to the fable of the Tower of Babel. So it's a fascinating book. I highly recommend it. Lexicon. It's a good read too. To download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you get to keep the book for free. Okay, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, the British government wants its data back, and you won't believe the lengths it goes to get it. Take a listen to this and come on back. Breaking rocks in a hot sun. I fall for law in a low one. I fall for law in a low one. I needed money, God, I had none. I fall for law in a low one. I fall for law. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuakin. The National Security Agency has broken privacy rules or overstepped its legal authority thousands of times each year since Congress granted the agency broad new powers in 2008, according to an internal audit and other top secret documents. Most infractions involved unauthorized surveillance of Americans or foreign intelligence targets in the U.S., both of which are restricted by statute and executive order. They range from significant violations of the law to typographical errors that resulted in unintended interception of U.S. emails and telephone calls. The NSA audit dated May 2012 counted 2,776 incidents in the preceding 12 months of unauthorized collection, storage, access to, or distribution of legally protected communications. So that's pretty it's pretty damning. The NSA is regularly breaking privacy rules in the thousands on a yearly basis, according to this report by the Washington Post. And not only that, but according to a another report by the Wall Street Journal, the NSA has the capacity to reach roughly 75% of all U.S. internet traffic in the hunt for foreign intelligence, including a wide array of communications by foreigners in America and Americans. In some cases, it retains the written content of emails sent between citizens within the U.S. and also filters domestic phone calls made with internet technology. Just when it doesn't seem like I can hear something more shocking about the NSA, another week rolls by and we hear more stuff that just blows my hair back.
To me, one of the things that's most impressive here is the hardware they're running to get all this information, right? Like this is not a question of somebody with some, you know, access to ISPs doing whatever. This is a question of their ability to really to process this data. Means mm-hmm. they have to have mm-hmm. a significant amount of resources, like an incredible amount of resources, that they can get to it. Okay, but the fact is they're looking at this data. They're doing these things that are quote unquote abuses. Just the fact that they're able to truly process this stuff is impressive, and that's what makes it frightening. You would think on some level, I think a significant amount of people are like, well, they could never get through all that stuff, but it seems like they can. And that's kind of what's kind of really scary about this, at least for me.
They're collecting it all and then sifting it later, but just the fact that they're able to collect it all is just incredible. Too. I mean, they must have huge data storehouses just to collect all this stuff and sift through it all. And of course, most of it is like literally 75% of the nation's traffic. That's stunning. That's a stunning figure. I mean, when you think about that, 75% of everything that you send out or is sent to you, I mean, that's fairly incredible.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's nuts.
That's what you call big data.
Yeah,
That's what you call humongous data.
This comes courtesy of The Guardian. David Miranda, the partner of Guardian journalist Glenn Greenwald, Greenwald, as you guys know, has written a series of stories revealing the mass surveillance programs by the NSA. David Miranda, his partner, was held for almost 9 hours on Sunday by UK authorities as he passed through London's Heathrow Airport on his way home to Rio de Janeiro. He was stopped by officers and informed that he was to be questioned under Schedule 7 of the Terrorism Act 2000. That controversial law, which applies only at airports, ports, and border areas, allows officers to stop, search, and question and detain individuals. He was held for 9 hours, the maximum the law allows, before officers must release or formally arrest the individual. According to official figures, most examinations under Schedule 7, over 97%, last less than 1 hour, and only 1 in 2,000 people are detained detained are kept for more than 6 hours. Now, Miranda was released, but officials confiscated electronics equipment, including his mobile phone, laptop, camera, memory sticks, DVDs, and game consoles. Glenn Greenwald said, "This is a profound attack on press freedoms and the news gathering process. To detain my partner for a full 9 hours while denying him a lawyer and then seize large amounts of his possessions is clearly intended to send a message of intimidation to those of us who have been reporting on the NSA. The actions of the UK pose a serious threat to journalists everywhere, but the last thing it will do is intimidate or deter us in any way from doing our job as journalists. Quite the contrary, it will only embolden us to continue to report aggressively."
The fact that the UK, obviously a special relationship ally to the US, is willing to go to these measures openly, brazenly, without any fear of reprisal from their government or anything, doesn't give me a lot of hope when it comes to the Western world, our promises of freedom, and what's going on here, you know, in terms of their just ability to grab press and to abuse it. I mean, if you want to detain someone, fine. Yeah. But the 9 hours without a lawyer and the warrantless taking of their files and records,
yeah.
That's not okay. You know, at the same time, the stealing of files and records is something that they're probably worried about too, just like how the U.S. is pissed that their records got stolen. Nobody wants their records stolen, but when a government does it and it uses its incredible power to do it,
yeah.
That's a little different than somebody who's been moved to do it because of their fear of government abuse. It's strange, especially because the weird thing is how brazen it was.
Yeah, agreed. It also hopefully is eye-opening to people who may have only thought that, you know, it's the U.S. who does things of this nature when it's definitely more widespread than that. And it's really sad to see in this state that something like that would occur, especially, you know, like he said, without any sort of legal awareness or obligation. I wonder if there's any sort of repercussions he can take, right? He just basically, all his electronics, including movies and things that you wouldn't think are necessary
benign for the government. Things, yeah.
Right, exactly. Benign things were confiscated, and right, like, is there any way he can get his money back for that? Or, you know, these may have some further value than further value to him than just material cost.
The UK government is definitely sending a chilling effect here to the to journalists, in particular, The Guardian. Guardian news chief Alan Rusbridger followed up this article with an incredibly revealing story about how he was contacted by a very senior government official claiming to represent the prime minister. He was told that they wanted the drives that they had that had the Edward Snowden data on it that was given to the Guardian, the encrypted data. The representative said, "You've had your fun. Now we want the stuff back." And then he had further meetings with other shadowy figures, and each of them demanded that they hand the Snowden material back or destroy it. During one of the meetings, he says that he asked directly whether the government would move to close down the Guardian's reporting through a legal route by going to court to force the surrender of the material that they're working on. The official confirmed that in the absence of handover or destruction, this was indeed the government's intention. And then two government security experts came over to The Guardian to oversee the destruction of the hard drives in The Guardian's basement, just to make sure there was nothing in the mangled bits of metal that could possibly be of any interest to passing Chinese agents or whomever might be involved. And as they swept up the remains of a MacBook Pro that was destroyed, one of them joked, "We can call off the black helicopters." It's a pretty damning and fascinating article that Rusbridger writes. about this incident. It just really sort of illustrates the lengths that the government is going to, the UK government, and I don't have any illusions that the US government is any less determined. But the UK government is going through such this amazing length to enforce their claim on this data.
The thing about the U.S. government, though, is that it's so the politics are such, though, that it's unlikely that they would work in this way without having, frankly, a PR plan for how to work this out, how to make it so that it doesn't get through this kind of press, you know? Like, if they're going to shoot somebody 45 times or whatever, you know, then it's just the cops saying, hey, we're the cops, we got to do that. But when it comes to at this level, at this time, Edward Snowden, all that stuff, it really is it's something that I don't think that our government would do without having, for lack of a better term, a backup plan for how to message about this.
Let's hope.
I'm not saying they wouldn't detain you, take your stuff, and whatever. I'm just saying that they
know that eyes will be watching.
Yeah, they understand that eyes will be watching.
They understand that it's already a touchy political atmosphere.
But they can, of course, they can hide behind that proviso that even talking about the what they can't talk about can can get them in trouble.
That's true, but there are people who, you know, if you got your stuff stolen, they're not going to tell you. If you got your stuff taken and ground to bits,
yeah,
there's nothing they can do in the U.S. to say, Andy, don't talk about this. Yeah. They can probably like maybe pay you off, whatever. But the fact is, they understand that they're gonna reap some huge scrutiny from that, from very powerful news organizations or other special interest groups, and it's not the route I think the U.S. would take right now. They would figure out either a more covert way or you'd be paid off really significantly. But that level of brazen, you know, destruction of property without a warrant is something that I'm not too worried about right now in this United States.
A U.S. military judge has sentenced Army PFC Bradley Manning to 35 years in prison. Manning faced up to 90 years behind bars while prosecutors sought to put the whistleblower away for a minimum of 6 decades. Manning will be credited the 1,294 days he spent in pretrial confinement plus an additional 112 days. According to an Army spokesman, Manning would be eligible for parole after serving a third of his sentence. With additional credit for time served, he could face 8 to 9 years realistically. Now, as you know, Bradley Manning, this was for his involvement in the 2011 WikiLeaks Iraq war data leak. So there you go. There's the final sentencing of Bradley Manning, 35 years in prison.
It sounds like the lawyers are going to appeal the sentencing. But it's also important to notice that I'm not going to say he got off light, but the prosecution was going for 90 years, full life term in jail. Like, just no way to get out.
Yeah.
No way to, you know, at least recoup some of that. The judge didn't see it that way. And his lawyer was asking for no more than 25 years. So the judge was a little harder on Manning than his lawyer said they should be. And the prosecution didn't get that crazy, you know, generational term.
Yeah.
But it definitely is. This guy's going to jail. He's going to jail for a while. And frankly, the government can't be seen as being too light on this.
Right.
The lawyer is going to appeal for a presidential pardon, to see if you can basically say, hey, look, this guy screwed up. But he did what he thought was right, Mr. President. Yada yada yada.
I don't see
Barack
that.
Obama will risk his political fortunes.
No.
I mean, granted, the president is on in his second term, but it's a big political risk in terms of getting past the scandals.
Sure. Yeah.
And this stuff happened on his watch, so the president needs to, you know, in many ways, I'm sure many would say that the president needs to have a firm grasp. on what's going on here.
I doubt that there'll be a presidential pardon in wake of Obama's recent stance on the more recent leaks, the NSA leaks. And you know, they did earlier take treason off the table, which would potentially carry a death sentence with it. So I guess from going from a death sentence to realistically 8 or 9 years, not too bad.
Not too bad.
Groklaw, the 11-year-old website devoted to covering legal disputes related to open source software, has announced that it will shut down rather than risk the government reading its email in just the latest of the recent corporate seppuku incidents that continue after the last week's the drill down we covered Secret Circle and LavaBit. Groklaw founder Pamela Jones, commonly known as PJ, wrote that she is not confident the government won't someday be able to crack her encrypted emails. Some cloud providers are taking that privacy seppuku pledge, stating they would shut down rather than aid the government. Additionally, Kim.com's mega service plans to launch its own encrypted email service next year. Jones isn't sure how long secure email will remain secure. She says, "They tell us that if you send or receive an email from outside the U.S., it'll be read, and as we've just read before, 75% of it is. If it's encrypted, they keep it for 5 years, presumably in the hopes of tech advancing to be able to decrypt it against your will and without your knowledge." Groklaw has readers all over the world. Jones herself wrote that she will try to get off the internet to the degree it's possible because, quote, "I can't stay online personally without losing my humanness now that I know ensuring privacy online is impossible." It's kind of sad because I really like that that blog, Groklaw. And it's a shame to see another victim of the privacy, the breach of privacy, commit this corporate seppuku.
I mean, it is the for lack of a better term, it's a pretty honorable thing to do. Hey, this goes against my privacy policy. I'm not changing my privacy policy, but I don't have the power to stop the government from doing what they're going to do. Therefore, adios for now. This happens all the time when it comes to other industries in terms of government regulations and government behavior making your industry one that is no longer viable. You know, medical marijuana. Other things are kind of on the fringe. And I'm not saying that Groklaw was on the fringe, but you're saying that it does happen from time to time, and it's unfortunate that this is a political issue that in many ways could have been avoided.
Yeah. Yeah, who knows how many others will follow in the wake of these companies, and if there will be any sort of reactionary change to come out of it, some sort of change in encrypted email or it's all up in the air. I think at this point we're in a transitionary period. All right, we're gonna take one last break, and when we come back, we'll tell you how to watch shows online from the BBC or any country for that matter, even if the content isn't allowed in your country. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Saracini, and I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Onofawakin. Now, Tosin, you brought up to me the idea of giving people a how-to on how to get content overseas that's blocked, streaming content that's blocked overseas. And where did this idea come from? Where did this request? Was this something, a personal issue that you were having?
Yeah, you know, for me, there's always content which you'd love to watch in the U.S. For example, if you guys recall when they had the opening Olympic ceremonies and everyone in the U.S. was delayed until, you know, late that night and couldn't watch the live stream, as well as, of course, anytime you watch things in the U.S., you have to get your own special commentary commentators. You miss that flair from the, you know, individuals from that actual region.
It also becomes somewhat, to just piggyback on what you're saying, if it's a live event like the Olympics, you're not getting that raw reaction. You're getting something that they've looked at, they've edited, and that they're ready to talk about in a more scripted way. And that is problematic as well.
Especially in this day and age with Twitter and all these social networks that everything comes to you immediately when it occurs.
Right. During the last Olympics in 2012, I remember walking around my office and people would say, "Oh my God, Gabby won." And someone else would be like, "Oh, shut up. I haven't seen it yet. I'm waiting until I get home." And you end up with that problem. That problem where you're just kind of you're kind of stuck looking at things in a – you have to sequester yourself from the world. And who wants to do that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know that I'm not a huge sports fan, but I know that this certainly would have helped a couple weeks ago when they unveiled the next Doctor Who live on in the UK, and all I could do is read tweets about it on the internet. I would have loved to have seen the streaming live from the UK, but of course, the BBC iPlayer is region coded, so that it blocks any IPs that it detects are not from the UK. And there's a terrific post on Lifehacker, and the Lifehacker post is titled "The Always Up-to-Date Guide to Streaming Blocked Content Overseas," which seems to be pretty self-explanatory there. And I'm assuming by always up-to-date, that means that they continuously go back and revise the article to give you stuff that works, so that when things end up not working, that they cycle that out and put in new techniques that do work. And apparently there's some there's extensions. There's an extension for Firefox and Chrome called the Hola Unblocker, which they say claims you can get access to Hulu, Netflix, Pandora, CBS, Fox, BBC, and more using that extension. There are alternative methods as well. Unblock.us use VPNs to essentially reroute your traffic through servers in other countries. TunnelBear, you can set up a proxy server, and they link to places to find out where to do that. And a service called MediaHint as well. So I have not tried any of these. Mainly because it hasn't been pressing enough of an issue for me to need the stuff from overseas, but I'll certainly keep this in mind in the future.
I wonder if there's any legal exposure associated with these. I feel like the article doesn't really get into it, but it's something to think about when you're going to get content that, for whatever reason, the copyright holder has not sanctioned for your area.
That is mostly the case. So use these at your own discretion.
At your own risk.
At your own risk.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
We do not endorse the downloading or the copyright infringement of anyone's protected works. But at the same time, we're here to inform.
But if you absolutely have to do it, at least there's a way to do it out there. All right, let's talk about our drill down video of the week. Dwayne, this is your choice this week. And I hadn't seen this up until just a few minutes ago before we talked about this. This is an advertisement.
Yeah, it's a Geico ad. They've been doing some really interesting stuff. Basically, Geico has kind of been A/B testing, it seems, a whole bunch of different spots around new characters. Not to replace the gecko, but you know, they're just checking out what's out there. The running theme in these are, in many of these spots are, you know, two guys with banjos and they have a little joke at the end. But really, this particular spot, it's all about Wednesdays, which is typically the day that we record the drill down. And you guys should go check it out if you haven't seen it.
Yeah,
a lot of people have seen it.
Yes. and appropriate to that we're recording on Wednesday, which is hump day, because it's the Geico's hump day camel commercial. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, check it out. It's pretty funny. And I think that wraps it up for this episode of The Drill Down. Let me go around the table here, and I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
flavors.me/DwayneD, Twitter/DwayneD, and you can always find me here on the Drill Down.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, ircwebcast.blogspot.com, and if you end up being in Seattle for PAX Prime next week, I will be around, so you can catch me there live.
Nice.
Okay. As well as come to the panel. I've got a panel on Monday at 11:30 about PAX and pranking PAX.
Do you know where in PAX the panel is located? What conference room?
The theater is, I'm pretty sure it's the Spider Theater. So it's going to be on the third floor, and I'll have to get you guys the name later, but it's the theater named after a spider.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Not a fan of spiders.
It's understandable. All right. Well, you'll have to give us some sort of report from PAX, like, you know, if you can't be there on the evening that record, at the very least, I'd love to hear a recap of what you saw.
Yeah, no, I definitely will. By the way, I was wrong. It's Raven Theater.
Ah. Are you a fan of Ravens?
I'm okay with Ravens. I am definitely okay with Ravens. Not okay with the Edgar Allan Poe film that showed recently.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, Facebook.com, MrBabyMan, and Twitter.com, MrBabyMan. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on The Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next time. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.